Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. I am your host, Dr. Weldon McWilliams. This is the Gist of Freedom, and today we'd like to welcome our guest, Dr. Will. I'm trying to find the.
Hey, that's just Will Mordock. There's no doctor there.
Oh, I'm sorry. How you doing, historian Will Mordock? How are you feeling this evening?
Fine. How are you, sir?
I'm well. I apologize for that. I wasn't sure
no
if there
problem.
Was a doctor attached to it or not. I didn't want to shortchange you there.
Nope.
Mr. Mordock, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and some of the things you are doing right now currently.
Well, I'm a journalist. That's what I am. You called me a historian, and I guess I read a lot of history, and I try to understand history. But I am a journalist by trade.
Okay.
And one of the things that I most like to read about and try to understand is Southern history and South Carolina history, and that's what I was writing about the other day in Charleston City paper, when Ms. Gist, I guess it was, contacted me and asked me if I would be willing to talk about Robert Smalls.
Yes, please. And if you can, just share with our listeners some of the things you've come across in the life of Robert Smalls.
Well, do your listeners know who Robert Smalls is? Do I need to go to the beginning on this, do you think? He is pretty obscure. I guess he is even in South Carolina history. Robert Smalls was a slave here in Charleston who was a pilot on a Confederate steam courier boat here in Charleston Harbor in 1862. And one night he and this black slave crew, they hijacked the boat. The whole crew went ashore and they were off doing something else, not minding the store. And the slave crew hijacked the ship. They went up the river, up the Cooper River, picked up their families, and then they steamed out of the harbor right past the coastal defenses, the Confederate coastal defenses. And as they approached the Union Navy blockading the harbor out there, they lowered that Confederate flag that was flying on this ship, and they ran up a white flag. Actually, it was a bedsheet, and they surrendered that Confederate ship to the Union Navy there. And Robert Smalls became a hero throughout the North. He was given a command position. He was given command of this it's called the Planter. And he served out the rest of the war fighting in the Union Navy, fighting against the Confederates there in Charleston. He later bought the house of his former owner down in Beaufort, South Carolina. He served in the South Carolina legislature. He helped to draft the Constitution, the state Constitution of 1868. He later served in the United States Congress representing South Carolina. And then when the Jim Crow laws were imposed after 1895, he was put out of all offices, and pretty much it was the end of his political career. But he is regarded as a great hero among many South Carolinians.
And I just wanted to, if you can, did you state that he was a pilot?
He was a pilot. He piloted, yes, this Confederate ship. He was not the commander. He was the pilot. He knew the harbor, yes.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his role. And so he was able to get this ship out of the harbor on his own, you know, late at night, past the coastal defenses and the sandbars and all the obstructions and whatnot in the harbor that had been placed there to control shipping in the harbor during the height of the war.
And would you say, you know, earlier I did a show and it spoke to the education or the desire of education for many enslaved Africans. So would you say the fact that he was able to pilot a ship, I mean, you need certain skills. What are skills that are needed to do such a work? And how does this relate to his education?
Well, and he had little education, and he was not literate, at least at that time in his life. He to pilot the ship, it just took a great deal of experience, you know, in the harbor, working on ships and that ship and others, and he, over the years, he knew the harbor. It did not take literacy to do that, but when he turned that ship over to the Union Navy, he and his colleagues, these slaves who had freed themselves, they were paid by the Union. In fact, it was by a special bill of Congress. They were paid a bounty based on the price of the value of that boat that they turned over to the United States Navy. It was considered war booty, and they were given a prize for it. And with that prize, Robert Smalls, among other things, he bought the house of his former owner. I mentioned that. But he also paid a tutor to teach him to read and write. And mm-hmm. with those skills, he was able to make quite an important impact on South Carolina politics for most of the rest of his life. It was a very, very remarkable life. And what the story that I wrote about, what I wrote in the Charleston City paper, was the fact that 2 weeks ago we recognized Robert Smalls here with a ceremony in the city. We unveiled two plaques, to his life and his work. But the fact is that he had been completely ignored by South Carolina history and the public for now 150 years. We used this event, the 150th anniversary, the sesquicentennial of his hijacking of this ship, the Confederate States ship, the CSS Planter. We used that event to hold services and a colloquium and the unveiling of two markers, you know, celebrating his life and his work. But until then, there was nothing on public display, nothing whatsoever to remind South Carolinians or anyone else who Robert Smalls was or what he did. And this is the way white Southerners have treated black history, well, really from the beginning. But mostly they ignored it, and if they didn't ignore it, they completely corrupted it and perverted it into something almost unrecognizable. In the case of Robert Smalls, his deeds were so heroic, there's really not much way you could misconstrue them or misinterpret them. So they have been just ignored by generations of white South Carolinians and keepers of history, of public history.
And you mentioned, and I was listening to the story that you were telling as far as when he captured the ship or stole the ship. Now, he took that ship north, correct? Did he bring it up north?
Nope. He just turned it over. I mean, the Union Navy was blockading Charleston Harbor. So he just piloted it right out of the harbor and turned it over to the ships right there, to the Union Navy right there. Now, as a matter of fact, later in the war, a couple of years later, he did take it up north to be refitted at a shipyard in Philadelphia. And it was at that time and place that he hired a tutor to teach him to read and write for the first time. And he was, at that time, in his mid-20s. And he had never had a day of schooling, never had a day of a pencil in his hand or a book in his hand.
But he did hire a tutor, which I guess would go to the point that education was something that many African Americans, although it was denied, it was still something that they pressed upon. Now, to be educated at that time was illegal to read and write at that time, correct?
In many states, in many southern states it was. And I think South Carolina was one of those states, yes.
Great.
I think it's important also, he was in the state legislature in 1868 when the legislature, now this was a Reconstruction legislature, you understand, and they passed the Constitution, the state Constitution of 1868, and it was that Constitution which created public education in South Carolina for the first time. And it had been in northern schools for generations to that point, in the northern states, excuse me. But in the South, public education was considered, up until the Civil War, up until we were able to overthrow that old Bourbon dynasty there of slaveholders and whatnot, education was considered to be a privilege for the elite and certainly for the white. With those old elements out of power and the Reconstruction government in power, we had public education in South Carolina for the first time, and Robert Smalls was very instrumental in making that happen. And he understood the value. He knew the importance of education, and he put it in the state constitution of 1868.
And I think that's very important information, and I think that's something our youth should definitely hold on to, in the sense that prior to this legislature in 1866, which Robert Smalls was a part of, education was something that was seen for primarily white people and the elites. And I guess to make the correlation of what's going on in education in America now, where it seems like maybe our youth just are not having an appreciation for it, and you begin to see movements now where, you know, education budget cuts are happening.
Yeah,
so,
it's happening. It's what we're doing in South Carolina here is a shame and a disgrace. I mean, yes, we are cutting back. It's just, I don't get me started on this, but yes, there are elements here who are trying to destroy the public education system. They want to defund it and take the money and put the public money into grants and vouchers and whatnot for private education. And that would be, if they had their way, we would just shut down the State Department of Education.
Right. Okay. Now, can you tell us that, can you give us the information about the blockade again, as far as what risks were involved in the act that Robert Smalls
What was involved, did you say?
The risks that were involved in Robert Smalls' capturing of the ship and
yeah,
returning it.
Well, I mean, I can tell you this, that if he had been caught, he would have been hanged before the sun came up. Before the sun went down again that day. I mean, what he was doing, it was beyond treason. I mean, for a slave to be presumptuous enough to do something like that was just mind-boggling. And, in fact, the white crew that had left their ship at the disposal of these slaves, I mean, they were court-martialed, and they weren't hanged, and they were eventually exonerated. But what they were doing, what they had done was considered so shameful, because they had allowed themselves to be duped by these slaves who, you know, were not supposed to be clever enough, smart enough to run a ship on their own. But needless to say, if they had been caught, that would have been the end. There would have been no appeal. He would have died surely, and very likely summarily. But it was a very, very bold act. He had to know, among other things, you know, he piloted the ship out of the harbor past Fort Sumter and other Confederate coastal defenses. He had to know the code. There was a code, a number of shorts and longs on the steamboat whistle that he had to know in order to pass these lookout points. And he knew the code. He gave the right, you know, shorts and longs on the whistle. And, in fact, they say some of the Confederate defenders there in Fort Sumter, who watched the ship go by, said that the crew in the ship, and they went back. It was late at night, you understand. So the visibility wasn't good. They couldn't see that these were black men, you know, piloting and manning the ship. They assumed that they were, you know, the Confederate crew. But some of the slaves on the ship waved at the Confederates there at Fort Sumter, on the Fort Sumter watch there, and just made it look as casual and natural as anything. And they just sailed right on out of the harbor. But it was a very daring, bold maneuver, and it's still legend. It's been legend in the black community, you know, for now 150 years, and now more and more white people are learning the story of Robert Smalls and what he accomplished. But it's just amazing how white Southern education managed to ignore this story and 100 others like it, I'm sure. I mean, I was raised in South Carolina, and I received the South Carolina education regarding slavery and the Civil War and whatnot, and it bears no resemblance to what actually happened. No resemblance at all.
Right, and yeah. If you can expound on that, and I kind of wanted to go back again to make a correlation to the education system, and you're acknowledging there's different stories being told. Can you just express some of your displeasure with some of the differences?
Well, yeah. I was raised with the South Carolina history book that was served the South Carolina public schools for decades, for literally generations, from the 1930s to the 1980s. It was a book by Mary C. Sims Oliphant, who was the granddaughter of William Gilmore Sims, who was an old Confederate, he was a writer, he was a prominent writer in the mid-19th century, and a Southern nationalist, a secessionist, and an apologist for slavery. And he passed that culture right along to his granddaughter, and she wrote the South Carolina history for the public schools for five decades there. And among other things, she wrote that South Carolina, that the South was very kind to its slaves, and the slaves were lucky to be, you know, own Southern plantations where they could be well fed and have Christianity taught to them and whatnot, and it was altogether a good deal and a very humane institution for slaves. This was
Mr. Mordack, can you hear me? This is Leslie Gist.
How are you, Ms. Gist?
I'm doing great. I'm so happy that you were able to join us tonight. I heard a comment that you said that rings so true with me when you were talking about the schools and how they were only for the rich. Could you explain, you know, the demographics and the literacy rate at that time when this took place?
Are you talking about at the time of the Civil War?
Right, when he stole the ship. You know, white people in schools, did they have public schools at the time?
No, there were no public schools in South Carolina at the time. If you wanted to get an education, you had to have, you know, enough. I mean, your family had to send you to a private school. And sometimes that private school was just a very local, you know, if you lived in a fairly good-sized town, there would be a private school there. But if you didn't, if you lived on a farm, out in the country, on a plantation, or whatnot, and if you wanted to go to school, you had to move into a town someplace that had a school. But schools...
Go ahead.
Well, schools were, one, they were for white people, and two, they were for white people of some substance. And this was... I mean, you have to understand that the social structure of that period was designed as much to keep poor whites down almost as it was to keep blacks down.
Thank you. I'm so happy you said it. That is the very point I wanted you to get to. And people have this notion that almost every white person in the South owned a slave. Could you talk to that?
Well, that was nonsense, of course. I mean, it's estimated, I don't know, I've read different figures, but, you know, I don't know, maybe 5 or 30% of white people owned slaves, and only a very few, very small percentage of those had more than two or three slaves, just to mind the house and the garden and that sort of thing. I mean, the people who ran South Carolina were large slave owners who had huge plantations with, in some cases, hundreds of slaves. And these families, that in South Carolina, it was the closest thing to a pure, you know, plutocracy that has ever existed in the United States. In South Carolina, you had a few dozen families, extended families, who ran the economy, who ran the state, who ran everything in the state. And they were all wealthy planters and landowners and merchants, mostly planters, but that was where the wealth was anchored in agriculture and in these large plantations. And of course it took large forces of slaves to make these rice and cotton plantations profitable. And that's what the whole Civil War was about.
And that's the other myth I wanted you to talk about. Now, you know, what we learned in school is that all slaves are either on a cotton plantation or a tobacco plantation. How did Mr. Smalls manage to get on the ship? How common was that?
Well, that's, as you said, that's another myth. I mean, one of the things that I do, I mean, here in Charleston is I give walking history tours. And one of the things that I make sure that my people, my clients understand is that this city was built by slaves. They built the bricks, they cut the timber, they fashioned the beams, the wood, they constructed the houses, the churches, the public buildings with their hands. I mean, this town was built by artisans, black artisans, and there were slaves who were fishermen, slaves who were ran any number of kind of anything that the city needed. There were black men doing it in some form. There was maybe just a few of them, maybe lots of them. I've got a friend now who's writing a book about a black tinsmith in Charleston. Here back before the Civil War, he learned his craft from his owner, and after the war he went off on his own and became very prosperous in the city here as a tinsmith. But yes, I mean, there were black people doing just about any line of work that needed to be done in any other southern city too.
From your research, what percentage, and I like how you described them as being artisans, what percentage was really based on pure labor, physical labor, and artisan and craftsmanship?
Well, the vast majority of slaves were agricultural workers, if that's what you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but in the city, I mean, and you understand these slaves, they were owned by their masters, but they were trained to be carpenters, brick masons, glaziers, whatever the work was needed. They were trained. They were highly skilled laborers and artisans, and their owners contracted them out to work for either, you know, a public service projects or private contractors or whatnot. And of course, the money that they earned went to their owners. But because they were highly skilled, you know, they would earn a lot more than, they'd be worth a lot more than a field hand.
And I have several questions rolling around, and I apologize.
Sure.
These slaves we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you said they were trained by their masters. Didn't many mm-hmm. of them come from different parts of Africa that were known for having these types of skills, iron workers?
The only one that I am aware of was the rice growers. Yeah, I mean, the rice was the first great crop in South Carolina that produced the first great wealth in this state. It was later supplanted by cotton, but rice produced an enormous, enormous amount of wealth in South Carolina. South Carolina grew more rice than any other region in the world for a time there, and it supplied all of North America and Europe. But that rice came from Madagascar, and the skills to grow it also came from Africa. And
you also mentioned earlier that because of these high-level skills, and Mr. Smalls, when, if you know in your research, when did he become a pilot, and how did that transformation take place?
Well, I'm not sure. He was born in Beaufort, South Carolina, which is, I don't know, 90 miles south of Charleston. He came to Charleston. His owner sent him to Charleston when he was 12 years old to work as an independent kind of contractor, and he sent his money back to his owner. But among other things, I mean, he waited tables and he did other kind of menial jobs, but at some point, fairly early on, in the late 1850s, he started working on boats in Charleston Harbor, and he must have shown some intelligence and Enterprise or whatnot, because he became a boat pilot. And it did take a good bit of skill to do that. And so when the war started, there he was, the boat that he had been working on for some time was pressed into service for the Confederate Navy, and he remained the pilot. And then his opportunity came to steal the boat and take it out of the harbor and turn it over to the Union Navy.
And earlier you mentioned with these skills that he had, and I read your article, phenomenal. That's why I called you. You mentioned an article that he did with slave time and master time, and that he had the ability to earn some money and keep some money for himself. That is another mythbuster.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is how in the urban areas, this is how a lot of the slave labor worked. I mean, they worked fairly independent of their owners. That is, sometimes they lived, you know, on their own. They would not report to their owners on a regular basis. But they did, you know, they were working. They had to show up at work, you know, every day and build the house or build the road or build the church or whatever it was that they were working on as artisans. They had to do this, and then, you know, on payday, they turned most of that pay over to their owner. It was a fairly loose system compared to the harshness of the field hands and what went on the remote plantations, where the slaves were very closely watched.
Now, I was a bit confused in your article. You state that he bought a house.
Yes, he did.
As a slave.
The house, in not as a slave. Hijacked, whatever. The Confederate boat and turned it over to the Union Navy. As I said, the United States Congress rewarded him and his crew by giving him the value of that war prize. They gave him the value of the boat. So here was a man who had, you know, never had a thing in his life, and suddenly he had quite a large little nest egg of money there. And among other things, he hired a tutor to teach him to read and write, and he bought the house of his former owner down in Beaufort, South Carolina. Because earlier in the war, in 1861, as soon as the Federals landed in Beaufort, in that area of South Carolina, all the whites it was called the Big Skedaddle. They just departed en masse. They left everything, left food on the table, they say. And there was his owner's house literally standing unoccupied. His mother was still living in quarters, small quarters, behind the house where she had been for decades. And the federal government took over the property and put it up for auction, and Robert Smalls bought it. And he moved into the house where his owner had lived and where he had spent, you know, his childhood in the back, you know, in the quarters in the back of the house there. He spent the rest of his life.
Did you ever find out what happened to this owner? Did he ever come back and try to reclaim his house?
That's a good question. Now, he did not. I don't know if he ever tried to reclaim it. He didn't reclaim it. But after the war, you know, it was there wasn't much sympathy for people like him. I'll just put it that way. For people like the owner, no, he left, and the federal government took it over and auctioned it, and Robert Smalls, and the house is still standing. It's a museum today. You can go down to Beaufort, South Carolina, and see it for yourself. Quite an interesting place.
How long did he live in that house?
Well, for the rest of his life. He died in 1915.
Wow, that's a long time.
Mm-hmm.
How old was he?
Well, let's see. I need to do the math.
He was born
in 1841. He was born in 1841, died in 1915. So he had a good long run.
Wow, he did. Especially for that time, that period. Now, when he commandeered this ship, Didn't he have some relatives on there that he helped free?
Yes, yes. His wife and children, pardon me, his wife and daughter were on there, and the families of some of the other slaves who were his compatriots in this expedition, he were also on there. So they were liberating themselves and their families.
Now, I always look at history, and I try to put myself in these heroic people's feet and shoes, rather. And I'm trying to think, why on earth would you go back to South Carolina? I always thought it was nonsense when I would hear stories that the slaves, even after the Civil War, would return back to the South. I wouldn't want anything to do with the South. I would think I would go to Canada or to the West.
Well, a lot of them did.
Gold mining.
A lot of them did.
How did
that
happen?
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question, and you'd have to ask a lot of people to get their feelings about that. But for a lot of people, I mean, this is the only home they've ever had. And this is where their ancestors are buried. This is where their churches and their homes stand. I mean, they did not want to live somewhere else. This was their home, and they wanted to claim it and make it their own.
Well, that's a personal question because my family is from Chester, South Carolina.
Well, you have a very South Carolina name, Ms. Gist, and I was wondering if you were going to get into that, all right?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons why I had to come on the show, because you know who Governor Gist is.
Yes,
I do. Right. All right, I'll let you tell the story.
Well, William Henry Gist was the secession governor of South Carolina. He was governor from 1858 to 1860, and he called the secession convention in 1860, and he was a member of that convention, and that convention voted unanimously to take South Carolina out of the Union. His cousin was a man named States Rights Gist, who was a Confederate commander who was killed at the Battle of Franklin in 1864. And there were other Gists too, but I told you earlier that, you know, South Carolina was run by a few dozen wealthy, powerful families, and the Gists were one of those families.
Well, from my research, he was not truly a Gist. He changed his name. Wasn't his name originally Bobo?
I can barely hear you. Go ahead. Speak up. Can you say that again?
Wasn't his name originally Bobo, and he changed his name to Gist?
That I don't know. I have not read that. I mean,
okay.
You might be right. You maybe know more about it than I do.
Yeah,
but,
check
but he
that
was
out.
From
mm-hmm.
Okay. But,
yeah,
but
I know
Henry...
States Rights and Independence Gist, but
okay.
I'm pretty sure, and Nathaniel Gist, that his name originally, and I got this information from the plantation and
mm-hmm.
the Rose Hill
mm-hmm.
mansion where he lived.
Mm-hmm.
He had changed his name. He was somewhat of a rebel. Do you know much about William Henry Gist? How he acquired his wealth?
No, I don't. I mean, I assume
okay.
he did it as a planter.
Well, that's another show. That's another
okay.
show.
Okay, all right.
But let's get back to Smalls. This blockade, we want the audience to understand what was going on at this time. Explain what a blockade is, and how did it come about?
Well, at the beginning of the war, President Lincoln, part of his strategy for defeating the South was to blockade the entire southern coast. And if you know a little bit about southern history, you know, there were blockade runners. These were considered to be rather glamorous and glorious characters who had these very fast ships that tried to go in and out of the Confederate harbors past the Union blockade. If you recall from Gone with the Wind, which I don't recommend anybody read or see, but there was a fellow named Rhett Butler from Charleston, South Carolina, and he was a blockade runner. But the point is, the whole Confederate coast was blockaded by the Union Navy, and including a number of ships right here around the Charleston Harbor to keep Charleston completely cut off and starve this Confederacy to death. And it was very instrumental in doing that, ultimately. But this was the blockade that Robert Smalls when he approached, and think about this, think about the danger of what he was doing. I mean, here he steamed out of Charleston Harbor at 4 o'clock in the morning of May 13th, 1862. He steamed out of the harbor under, you know, kind of a half-moon sky, so there was a little bit of light there, but not enough. And he was approaching this Union blockade at full speed with the Confederate flag flying. And if there had been, if he had had a bad day, if something had gone wrong, those Union ships would have opened up on him. But he was quick enough, smart enough, he knew that the time was right. He was out of range of Confederate guns behind him. And he pulled down the Confederate flag and ran up onto the flagpole a sheet, which his wife had brought along with their few possessions. He ran that white sheet up on the flagpole, and the Union sailors could see that sheet, and they did not fire on him. But that is just a remarkable damn story.
It sure is. Are there any similar stories in any part of the South where another black person, slave, did something equally heroic?
I mean, nothing that dramatic that I am aware of. I mean, certainly, you know, blacks were used as spies and scouts and whatnot in other roles by Union forces during the course of the war. But there was that what Robert Smalls did that night is just absolutely astounding when you think about it. That was just one of the most amazing feats. And they make movies about things like that.
And that was one of my questions.
About things like that.
That was one of my follow-up questions. Are there any movies, books, documentaries, plays?
None that I am aware of. Like I say, this is a story that was largely written out of South Carolina history for so long. It was something, I mean, white people control the history, and that was something they didn't want to talk about.
Well, it sounds like you are one of the people that helped to revive it.
Well, I like to think I am, but I mean, the revival has been going on for a few decades now. I'm sort of getting in on the crest of the wave, but other people have made it happen.
Now, if Robert Smalls was alive right now, who do you think he would thank for resurrecting this story?
Well, I would like to think that he'd be modest enough to say, oh, gosh, you know, I was just doing my part, doing my duty. I don't know what he wouldn't recognize.
He would thank you, for sure, for that wonderful article. Who
well, bless you.
Do you
thank
think
you.
He would thank to say, thank you for preserving my legacy? Who
well,
else is instrumental?
There were a number of the Preservation Society, there were a number of historical and scholarly societies that were involved. A couple of weeks ago to preserve to unveil these markers to have this colloquium and the other things to observe the sesquicentennial of his great act of heroism there. I mean, no, it was not any individual, and it wasn't even a single group. It was one of those ideas whose time has come. I mean, 150 years after the Civil War, it's time we start talking about these things.
Wonderful. Now, the family, are there any living descendants in the area?
Not in the area, I don't think, but there were some at this event. His great-great-great-grandson, I think, and a great-great-granddaughter. They were here as part of a couple of the panel discussions, a colloquium. So, yes, there are some, but none of his descendants bear the name Smalls. He had only one son who died at a very early age, so his daughters were the only children who came of age, and as a result, to this day, he has no living descendants by the name of Smalls.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, before we close, there were a lot of things that you mentioned very early on this interview that Smalls accomplished after the Civil War. Can we start off with the first one?
Well, I mean, he was elected to the legislature, the state legislature, representing Beaufort down there south of Charleston, just north of Savannah, Georgia there. And in that capacity, he was he helped to draft the Constitution of 1868. And that was, it was that Constitution which, among other things, it created public education in South Carolina for the first time.
And for everyone, or just for African Americans?
For everyone, for everyone. Ever been public schools in South Carolina. And so for the first time, and you've got to understand also, there was not segregation in South Carolina at that time. There was, things were remarkably open, you know, society was, it wasn't, well, I'm fascinated reading about how people worked through that period, but the big crackdown, the rise of the right wing, the people who overthrew the Reconstruction government and then imposed the Jim Crow laws. That didn't come until later, but for a few years there, yeah, everybody lived side by side and went to school side by side and pretty much worked side by side.
And that's another myth that you're busting tonight. I had a guest a few years ago say that Charleston, I think it was Charleston or Savannah, I'm not sure, wasn't affected by the Civil War. Was Beaufort and Savannah destroyed?
No, neither of them were destroyed. No, they both surrendered pretty much without a fight.
Okay. Well, this woman made the point that the rebuilding, the reconstruction, brought both races together because everybody wanted to rebuild their city. And he said that was one of the reasons why there was some harm in other southern cities. Do you find that to be the case?
Well, certainly everybody wanted, the Civil War was hard on everybody in the South. I mean, at least the black people could say they got their freedom out of the deal, but there was a great deal of poverty. Everybody was diminished, you know, materially by it. And I would like to think that there was some working together and pulling together to rebuild the South, you know, as neighbors and whatnot, but they had different agendas, I think. The black people wanted to create one kind of a new society, and the white people wanted to return to something as close to the old society as they could. And they worked mightily, and they worked violently, and they did everything in their power to put out the Reconstruction government and seize control and put blacks out of power in any way they could and start imposing segregation and all the worst aspects of the Jim Crow South that I grew up remembering.
Wow. That's what you're saying is, for you to have lived through the Jim Crow.
Well, I remember the tail end of it. I was born in 1950, and yes, I remember the whites only, you know, signs and whatnot. So, you know.
Wow. I know you mentioned he was in government,
mm-hmm.
and he was responsible for the education. Any other
mm-hmm.
things?
He was elected to Congress. He served in the United States Congress for 10 years, I believe. He was not 10 contiguous years. It was he was out of office for some of those years when he was defeated. But he was there for 10 years, and then after the Constitution of 1895, and there was a convention in 1895 that created this Constitution. And are you familiar with Pitchfork Ben Tillman?
No, I'm not at all.
Okay, he was the governor and later the United States Senator, but he was the great evil force in South Carolina who mobilized the agrarian whites to create a new constitution that would disenfranchise black people, take away the vote, put them out of office, and create the Jim Crow laws. This was done by the Constitution of 1895. And it's one of the most dramatic things. I mean, I've read about it, and to think that Robert Smalls and four other state legislators were at that convention, otherwise all of it was white people. And their purpose there, the white people's purpose there, was to strip black people of all political power and make them second-class citizens. And there, Robert Smalls and his four colleagues addressed this convention, begged, you know, for some kind of, you know, accommodation, something that would give them some dignity, some freedom in their own state, in their own homes. It was all taken away from them. It was all stripped away. The white convention here passed this horrendous constitution, created this horrendous constitution to disenfranchise the black population, to put all blacks out of office, and to create the Jim Crow laws that lasted up until the 1960s. And also, I mean, part of that corollary of that was that we entered into the great era of lynching at that time, because, you know, blacks had no power in South Carolina. This was going on throughout the South at the same time, you know, from you know, Maryland all the way down to Texas throughout the time, in one form or another. But in a period of a decade there, Jim Crow legislation was passed in every southern state. And the lynching, the wave of lynching that became so prevalent for the next 40 years or so, began in that decade also.
Terrible. But it's these stories of success, like you're bringing out with Smalls, that, you know, that show that throughout all of these terrible, tedious evils that was committed against African Americans in the South and in the North too, that Smalls was able to prevail. And like you mentioned much earlier in the interview, he's not by himself. There's hundreds of stories similar to his. It's just that we don't have enough people like you who are willing to do the work and dig these stories up and share them. I think they bring a lot of hope to people who feel hopeless. You know.
Well, it is a story of great hope, isn't it? That somebody would have the daring and the wits and the wild to do something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that, I mean, it's just an astounding story. Every time I read it, I can't get over it. I think, holy moly, he actually did that.
And the reason why you can't get over it, which is a poor testament to the image that is depicted of our black men in generally,
well,
till today, to think that that's very heroic and unusual. I think if enough people dig up their stories, we'll find that it was very common.
Okay, well,
it's only uncommon because the stories are buried. Would you agree?
No. I mean, I think my point is this, that it is an astounding story regardless of who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime or mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds, I mean, it sounds like some kind of Alistair MacLean novel.
Right, right. Well, we need
adventure.
To,
I mean, it's the kind of thing it's almost sounds like a James Bond caper.
Right.
It's an astounding story.
Right. And for him to come back to the South.
Yeah, and he came back to his hometown. But he
and
came
flourish.
Back, you know, a conquering hero, really. He was because in that majority black community, I mean, yes, he was a hero. And he bought his master's house and lived quite well for the rest of his life. So, yes, and he had, I guess, maybe a better reason than a lot of former slaves for coming back. But the big thing, I mean, you've got to understand, when these slaves, you say, well, they all head to Canada or someplace. And, you know, some did, but they had nothing. They had nothing in Canada, at least. In South Carolina, wherever they lived, they had their ancestors' graves, they had their you know, churches, their communities. They understood a little bit about the little world that they lived in there, and they didn't want to lose that.
Well, you have been a fascinating guest. I learned a great deal tonight. I definitely want to keep in touch. I want to continue to read your articles. Could you give the listeners more information on how we can follow you?
Well, my column, my weekly column, runs in Charleston City Paper, and you can go online to charlestoncitypaper.com and see it each week.
Okay. Now, do you have any goals in writing a book or do anything?
Well, I wrote a book some years ago about Myrtle Beach, and the way that has been. I don't know how much you know about Myrtle Beach.
It was destroyed by
the developers and the corrupt politics and whatnot up there. I mean, what's there today is not what I remember from growing up here in the state 60 years ago. So my point is this: it was a very good book. I was proud of it. It's out of print now. I'm planning here to update it and create an ebook, and maybe we can talk about that some too at some point.
I'll be more than happy to.
Okay. I mean, I know a lot of your listeners go to Myrtle Beach because, well, it's just 14 million people a year go to Myrtle Beach, and maybe we can talk about that sometime.
We will. And I want to thank you again for coming on.
My pleasure.
And any parting words, adages, anything you want to leave?
I would just say, you know, read. I tell everybody, you know, I teach writing classes over at the College of Charleston, and I say if you want to do anything, you have to read. Just read. Read good books. Read professionally written, professionally edited books by people who know what they're talking about, and just read, you know?
Right.
Read. Read history,
right.
Read politics. Yeah.
Well,
all right.
Thank you again, and we
thank
will talk.
You.
In the future. Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you, Ms. Yes. Good day.
Bye-bye.